coexistence with living machines, of course, is a very multidisciplinary exercise. And for that reason, we also want to bring in people with different perspectives and different backgrounds. Warwick is coming at this from a more, let's say, conceptual angle. And I think we already gave him some challenges to deal with, and he promised to give us all the answers. So
we're really pleasure here. So. Well, thank you. No, thank you. No, first of all, I want to thank Tony for inviting me here. And I didn't know what sort of a crowd I was going to be dealing with. But once I heard the two talks from Emily and Paul, I felt very much at home. Let me start. I'm one of those useless philosophers that Paul was talking about in his talk. And in fact, I'm so useless, I'm a professor of sociology. But the point is that I actually have a sort of long-standing history of being interested in this general topic, what you might call biomimetics in a very broad kind of way. And just let me say something relatively concrete. Back in 2009, 2010, I was part of a project that was looking at mimetic factors in human behavior. Okay, how do people copy each other in various kinds of ways? And was looking at it from both a sociological and biological angle. And on the back of that, my colleagues and I, along with a couple of other people, decided to put forward a project which did not get funded. So it's still an idea that has yet to be realized. But it was the idea was to have examine a kind of common environment in which robots, animals, and humans cohabited, and to look at the patterns of imitation amongst them. And how would, and you know, and this would be a very much an exploratory exercise in the sense of trying to figure out how would you characterize imitation when you're dealing with things that are so radically different in kind. Okay, so the other people who were involved on the robotics side was Alan Winfield of the University of West of England, who does a swarm robotics stuff, and I got some exposure to that when I was involved in this other project on mimetics, and a guy named Henry Buller at the University of Exeter, who is a geographer who's very much interested in ecological patterns. And so the idea would be, what would be a kind of, how would you forge a common ecology, and what would be the patterns of interaction and potential imitation behaviors between radically embodied beings? And you know, the motivation for that wasn't just conceptual. I mean, we sort of set this proposal. It was going to be a joint proposal between the ESRC, so the Social Science Funding Council, and the EPSRC. Okay, it did not get funded, but the idea wasn't just conceptual, but it was also because we sort of imagined that in the future, people will be increasingly living in these mixed embodied environments. And so then the question becomes, how do bonds form? Are there patterns of imitation? Because one of the things that's interesting, I think, about the very idea of biomimetics is that it starts with the assumption that there's something that needs to be copied. What needs to be copied from what, exactly? Okay, and that's a theme that I want to return to here in the talk. So that's at a kind of, you might say, concrete research angle, which I think still deserves to be explored in some kind of way, namely the spontaneous forms of imitation that take place in social communities, when you're not necessarily thinking about it from a strategic standpoint, which I think is pretty much how biomimetics normally operates, where you identify a function and then you say we're going to re-embody it in some way. Okay. So that's kind of in a way there's this kind of research project that has yet to be realized, which could bring together, you know, animal ecologists and roboticists and people who study, you know, sociology, for example. But what I want to do, in a way, is to go back to philosophy, because that's, in a sense, my comfort zone, and maybe get at this idea of biomimetics a little bit differently, at least at the beginning, from how you might normally think about it. And here, I don't want to go back to Hobbes, I don't even want to go back to Locke yet, though Locke will make an appearance later, but I want to go back to Plato, and I want to go back to this dialogue of his, the Phaedrus, I don't know if you've read Plato, but the Phaedrus is normally seen as a dialogue about the nature of love. But actually, it's about what we're talking about, because the claim that is being made by the sophist, and you know, Socrates in Plato's dialogues is always dialoguing with the sophist. The claim that's being made by the sophist in this is that, in a way, the best kind of lover is, you know, from the standpoint of the person receiving the love, the best kind of lover is someone who doesn't actually feel it. Okay, because then there's less damage done. Because people who, in fact, are really in love tend to be mad. Now, so the point here is that there is something good about receiving love. There's no doubting that. No one's disagreeing with that point. People want affection. They want, you know, all of that stuff that comes with love. They like the phenomenology of being loved, okay? But what they don't want is the sort of causal factors that tend to be behind it, because it can have very negative unintended consequences, you might say. Right? So, you know, this madness might lead to kind of possessiveness, jealousy, you know, all this kind of stuff, right? This is what the sophist has in mind. So that from that standpoint, right, the best kind of lover is the one who doesn't really love you, but is able to demonstrate the effects, as it were, can function as a lover. This is a biomimetic moment here. Right? This is a biomimetic moment. Right? Because you've identified the function. You've identified the function, you know, and now you're thinking about what's the best way to embody it. Because the way in which it's normally embodied can actually be pretty deleterious. It can have all kinds of negative consequences. So what you want is a better, cleaner way of embodying it. A more energy-efficient way of embodying it. Right? So you don't have to worry about your life being in jeopardy and stuff like that. Right? This is where a lot of this pet stuff starts to look good. Right? You know, so the thing here is, this is right here, you know, at the dawn of Western philosophy in Phaedrus, we have got the biomimetic question front and center, it seems to me, right there, right? And Socrates isn't having it, though. This is the interesting point, right? Because what I've just given you, which to a lot of you may sound incredibly persuasive, is a sophist's viewpoint. This is the thing Socrates is against. Socrates is against people thinking this way. Okay? And his argument, right, is going to be that in fact this madness, so he doesn't deny that madness goes along with love. He thinks it, he grants the point. But that madness has to be understood holistically. Okay? In other words, it isn't merely the source of jealousy and all these kind of negative things that can have bad consequences for the person who's loved. But it's also, this is madness is actually part of a kind of larger phenomenon of human beings that actually enables them to be in touch with bigger things, with greater things, with the cosmos. Right? So Socrates believes, this is Socrates' view, right? So in other words, while the madness that is associated with love may be bad in the context of love, nevertheless, it's an overall kind of disposition of humanity. It's actually quite good in that it enables us to engage in a certain kind of self-transcendence that we otherwise would not be able to do. Right? So this is Socrates' view for defending the madness of love. Right? And that's saying that it really does matter that you really, you know, have it. Okay? And this is a very interesting thing, because what you know, and I think, you know, what Socrates is pointing to here, again, from the standpoint of biomimetics, is exactly at what level does one want to talk about functionality, you might say, right? Because one can talk about functionality in a fairly narrow sense, right, which is what the sophist is doing, and I think that's kind of the more familiar sense of talking about functionality. But then there's this other kind of organic kind of functionality, right? You know, in other words, if you want to be a certain kind of being in the world, what sort of functionalities do you need to have as a whole? And actually, this goes a little bit to the point that Paul was raising about consciousness and about the way he was conceptualizing consciousness. I don't think philosophers would actually call what you're talking about consciousness, but nevertheless, I understand the spirit of what you're saying, and it's trying to capture a certain kind of complex notion of autonomy, okay? That enables, you know, decisions to be reached based on a range of factors, that has a kind of foresight attached to it, And in a sense, that's the thing, that's the level at which the functionality needs to be modeled, at this kind of larger, more holistic level. Okay? And in a sense, that aspect, you might say, the human beings clearly have. It's something that needs to be preserved, even though it cannot necessarily be reduced to a very particular, specific kind of function that you could just hive off and say, this is the thing you want. Okay? So I think when you go back to the beginning of philosophy, you sort of see people already grappling with this kind of stuff, right? And Plato's particularly good at this because part of what Plato's dynamic is with Socrates as a character is to always figure out what's the real and what's the fake, right? Because the sophists are always claiming that yes, human beings are like this, but it's usually not very efficient, and there's actually a better way of doing it that cuts corners and actually gets you what you want more efficiently. That's what the sophists say. And that's very much like the people, I would say, you know, who want to design more efficient machines that can do things that humans can only do very clumsily or with a lot of energy, blah, blah, blah. Okay? And Socrates always comes back and says, but you're missing something. Okay? So if you ever do a kind of legitimation story for biomimetics, you know, when you want to go back to philosophy, this is where you go back, right? In a sense, this is where sort of the story begins in a way. And I think it's always worth keeping that in mind, in a sense, especially since, you know, I mean, especially this, I mean, I think this is true, it was very striking, because when you think about biomimetics, it's very easy, at least if you look at the way the literature works, it's very often very functional specific, right? Very narrowly functional. But in these two talks that I heard this morning from Emily and from Paul, they were very holistic in a sense. They were, you know, if there was any kind of imitation going on, it was imitation of whole organisms and their whole properties, and, you know, everything that they can do as an entity. Okay? And I think that's a very interesting aspect of this, and I think that's a very important thing to keep in mind. And in this respect, I think a dialogue like Phaedrus is an interesting one to go to, especially if you are thinking about, you know, designing some kind of biomimetic kind of love proxy, you know, or something of that kind. But now, one of the things, the issue that Phaedrus and other Platonic dialogues bring up is the extent to which the actual embodiment of the function is necessary, or whether it can be done in some more efficient way. Right, and typically Socrates is always defending the embodiment. Okay. Now, I think one area where one might want to think about this issue in a general sense, and I'm not going to go into too much detail here, but it's in terms of this business of brain versus computer. Okay, to my mind, maybe I'm reading something wrong here, but the brain is a hell of a lot more efficient than a computer. And the whole idea of trying to reproduce the brain in a computer, you know, it's not that it can't be done, it's that it's a nightmare. I mean, you know, from an energy standpoint, I mean, what's the point? The brain is already doing it very efficiently. In fact, if anything, one would want to think about this the other way around, right? In other words, you might want to think about how could you grow brain cells to do computational functions regularly. Right, so you can have, as it were, organic computers made of brain cells, rather than actually using the kinds of stuff we normally do. See, in other words, what we're talking about, what needs to copy what? Okay, the most impressive thing about the brain, it seems to me, from the standpoint of the various parameters that we could be talking about here, is energy efficiency. Right, it has to do with the constitution of the cells and the biology of it and all that. And so then the question becomes, how can we exploit that biology in the best way possible? Not how we can reinvent what the functions are of the biology in some kind of other silicon-based form, but rather how do you exploit the functions of the biology? Right? How can you have like organic computers and things of that kind? I mean, so all of the idea, you know all this stuff about using the DNA as a basis for storing information, so now you can have the entire Library of Congress in the United States in some little DNA strand or something like that. That's very impressive, actually. Right? I mean, this which suggests that, you know, as it were, the material that one should be working with from a biomedics is to take the biology much more seriously as the stuff that you are to actually exploit. Not that something you want to replace, but something you want to exploit. Okay? And you know, in terms of the expertises of the people who are here, I mean, I don't know how that plays out exactly, and whether there is some very strong kind of carbon versus silicon thing going on. Okay, but I would have thought that if you take the biomimetic ideal seriously, namely what you want to do, the functions that you want to amplify and you want to optimize, you should be, as it were, substratum neutral. In other words, where, you know, whatever material actually amplifies and optimizes the function best for you, that's the one you go for. You don't just assume it's always going to be silicon. Okay? I think that would be kind of an interesting sort of idea. You know, there's a kind of a historical kind of precedent for this, which doesn't have to do with brains, and that only has to do with pigeons, actually. Pigeons are animals, as you know. And this goes back, you've heard of B.F. Skinner? Okay, so B.F. Skinner, great behavioral psychologist, in World War II, he trained these pigeons to be able to guide missiles to where they needed to hit the boats, right? And he got a grant from the United States government to do that, and they were pleased, and those pigeons did the business. Okay, so the pigeons were fine, there was no problem with the pigeons, but he didn't get a renewal of the grant after World War II. And why was that? Well, that was because the guys who were working on the computers at the time figured out how the pigeons did their business, and they came out with automated systems that could be put into the airplanes that could actually do the pigeons' work without the pigeons. And this is often regarded as progress. Now, isn't that how Skinner saw it? Skinner saw it that, look, these animals who are already there, you don't have to make them, they make themselves quite plentifully, right, are actually there, you can train them, all you need to do is to design the right environment in which they do what they normally do, and boom, you blow up battleships. It's much cheaper than, as it were, reinventing the wheel itself. Okay, so Skinner's view, right, and Skinner's whole modus operandi with regard to operant conditioning, and if you know the history, you know, of that kind of form of behaviorism that he carried forward into the 1970s, right, was about that, right? It was the idea of thinking about the organism as a kind of machine, and in a sense, you sort of examine it, and you say, what is this good for? We see what it normally does, you know, without much effort, without our having to do very much. So what could it really do that would be a benefit? And then you place it in that environment. And so the clever thing is to design the environment so they do what they do naturally, but now it has an even greater positive effect than it would have otherwise. Right? That was what operant conditioning was about. Okay? And so that's a very, you know, that kind of angle on things, from the standpoint of energy efficiency and trying to think about, you know, the functionality of the world and all this, there's a certain logic to this, okay? And it's not the logic that says that everything we find wonderful and valuable in nature, we have to reinvent a computer. Okay? And so, you know, in a way, one needs to be, this is why I think that if you're going to be doing this biomimetic stuff, you have to be kind of neutral or open-minded with regard to where is it going to act, you know, what is copying what exactly? And it may well be, you know, that a lot of things that at the moment even that we think have to be mechanized or automated or computerized could actually, there are natural processes that could do this for us much more energy efficiently. And we just, as it were, need to turn our attention to think in those terms. And you don't have to be some kind of weird green ecologist bullshit thing. No, you could be B.F. Skinner and think this. Okay? And so I think that this is one, you know, in a way it's a kind of, you know, you'd be talking about conceptual challenges for biomimesis, but I think this is a very important one here. Namely, that there are things that nature already does very well, very efficiently, which if we provide the right environments could do even more work for us as far as we're concerned. Okay? Now, I know that's very exploitative and so forth, and that's a conversation we might need to have, actually, about the exploitation of nature in that very specific sense. Not just the exploitation of nature in the sense of wasting it, but the exploitation of nature in terms of using it as effectively as possible on its own terms, taking advantage of itself. That's the kind of exploitation I'm talking about here. And that's what Skinner is about. Okay? Now, I want to move on here and talk a little bit about this issue that Emily raised, which I was, you know, I come in here completely ignorant of what people are about, and then Emily starts talking about ass and rat and all these things. I want to put an issue on the table, and this will bring up the business about the difference between, you know, the difference, if there is any substantial one, between the animals and the android pets and so forth, and even maybe the issue of the life and death, which Emily brought up, which I again didn't expect to come up, but I think is a very salient one, right? Her point was that there is this kind of qualitative difference between the animal and the android with regard to people's attitudes toward them in terms of, you know, the animals can die, but the androids can't, okay? And in a sense, the animals can perform a kind of significant therapeutic function, perhaps the androids can't, because of that very fact, right? That's kind of basically the argument. Here I want to sort of present a little case to you that I've just become acquainted with recently. And one of your questioners, Emily, brought up the Tamagotchi thing, which you just dismissed. But in fact, there is a second coming or third coming of these things. And so the one I want to draw your attention to is not out yet, but will be commercially available in the spring. And I do not earn any money from this. Trust me, I'm an innocent party just having found out about it. And this is called, it's an acronym PET, personalized entitative technology. I get that? See? So what do you do with this thing? Okay, so the idea here is it's a familiar kind of format. What you do is, when you buy into this thing, you're able to design your virtual pet, and your virtual pet, by the way, can live a kind of parallel existence to you. So once this pet has been conjured up virtually, you can project it, so that if you're walking around with your smartphone, your pet's kind of also there too in some form. And not only that, your pet also has a kind of independent existence, and it does the kinds of things pets do. They respond to affection, of course, and the rest of it, but they also do crazy things from time to time, even while you're trying to walk across a busy street or something like this, okay? So it's pretty realistic in this regard, okay? You can design this pet. You have all kinds of options. The pet turns out to be a kind of dog. And the thing is there's a two-day gestation period for this pet. So part of the thing with this particular game is it wants you to get a sense of a life cycle going on with this pet, okay? So it takes 2 days actually for the pet to come into being once you've specified what you want. And then the pet lives for 30 days on average. But it can be less or more depending on how you treat it. Moreover, the company that you'd be buying this pet from actually monitors your interactions with this pet and can actually take the pet away from you or make it impossible for you to purchase another pet in the future once the first one dies, okay? Because you're not a fit pet owner, okay? And by the way, this company is called OmniScience. Okay, that's the name of the company. Now the person who's designed this, who brought this to my attention, is actually someone whose degree is not in computer science, but is in writes screenplays. Okay, so this is a person with a very vivid imagination about all kinds of scenarios and things like this, and she provides all these things, and then you end up getting a kind of very comprehensive sort of life world for this virtual pet that you interact with. Now, one of the things in the trial runs, so this thing is not yet commercially available, but it will be in the spring. One of the things that's come up in the trial run is that it's the issue of life and death. Okay? As I pointed out to you, the pet has to die roughly within 30 days, give or take a few. That is actually part of the way the product works from the standpoint of the manufacturer. Right, so it's supposed to give the person who's the pet owner the experience of what it's like to own a pet, but it's important from a financial standpoint because this is the thing you purchase and the thing expires, right? It's planned obsolescence, right, as they say in the business world, right? This pet just dies and we need another one after that, okay? So that's very important. So it does this dual function. It both creates the reality of life, which has a termination, but it also seals the sale and guarantees the next one potentially. Okay? So what they're finding, the people doing this, is that there are some users who are very clever who are trying to hack the program to keep the pet alive as long as possible, to make it impossible for the pet to die. Okay? Now this is very interesting. So now, you know, when we think about what's going on here from the standpoint of the value of life and how that gets translated into this kind of more android medium, it's an interesting kind of thing, right? So there is, as it were, the transfer of the affection for life from the animal to the machine, but the way it manifests itself is not by an acceptance that the animal can die, or the android can die, but rather that it needs to be kept alive as long as possible. Okay? So the point is, this life-death thing actually does. It ends up carrying on. This is the point I would raise, you know, in light of what Emily said. This the significance of life versus death carries on in the android world, but manifests itself in a different kind of way, namely in terms of the possibility of extending the life indefinitely once you know what the program is. Okay? And so I think it's an interesting kind of feature about this. And by the way, the kinds of qualities that are being advertised for this personalized entertainment technology, very much like what Emily was saying in terms of its being, something that you know, shows affection, shows love, you know, does all sorts of wonderful personal things for you and you show back to it. It has exactly the same kind of character to it, okay? So to me it seems that it does kind of blur a line a little bit between the animal and the android. And so I guess this then raises the question of what kind of a distinction, because to be honest with you, I wasn't so sure whether the distinction between the animal and the android would actually be so prominent in this kind of conference. And in fact, it seems to be actually fairly prominent, at least in her talk, it was quite very prominent. And maybe even in your talk, Paul. But the point is, I want to draw some, there's some very interesting aspects of this. Because, you know, one of the things, when we talk about pets, in a way, pets are already kind of a blurry category. Because pets are not valued for their own sake, really. Right? I mean, especially if you're an animal rights person, this is crystal clear. Right? If you believe in animal rights, pets are a bit like a kind of comfortable slavery. Right? And so it's not surprising that historically, and Emily rightly pointed out about John Locke, right? So John Locke starts this whole idea that people being able to take care for domestic animals, right, is a way of learning how to care for things generally, but that's a kind of bringing husbandry into the house. Right? In other words, you already start with the assumption that there are some systematically exploited animals, and it's okay to do that. But those animals, the ones that are in the farm, are the ones that provide food for you and your labor and all the rest of it. But now what you're going to do with John Locke is you're going to have animals that can develop your psychology. Right? You're going to have, so instead of the animals feeding you, the animal, you know, feeding your body, animals will feed your mind by giving you this kind of opportunity to take care for, to develop your feelings, to express things, right? But nevertheless, the animals are still in a kind of servitude. Right? It's just now moving from a kind of physical servitude to psychological servitude. Okay? And it's not by accident, right? It's with John Locke that you actually start to get the kind of first modern development of what the person is and what the self is, and how that self has to, as it were, populate itself with the right kinds of memories and consciousness and things of that kind. And so the question then becomes, how do you acquire this, given you're somebody like Locke who believes it only comes from experience? If it comes from experience, what experience are we talking about? And so this is where the animals start to play a very functional role in the training up of human psychology. That's basically what the function of the pet is. You become emotionally deeper, psychologically deeper, right? All that kind of stuff. Right, because there's no presumption here that you already start out that way. You actually need to interact with these animals. Especially if you're a young person, right? Because before you have children, right? In other words, before you actually are in a position of responsibility, you need to know what it's like. But the point that I would make to you is that when you think about animals as having this kind of functionality, it is still exploitative. Right? We're not thinking about animals as autonomous. That's a very important point, it seems to me. Because even if we're talking about notions like reciprocity, because I think you brought this up, reciprocity doesn't necessarily require autonomy. It just requires a back and forth, feedback loop. It doesn't imply autonomy. Now, you see, this is kind of interesting, because animal rights people get very exercised about this point. And the thing they even get more exercised by, this is something that I discovered at a conference that took place at Yale, I mentioned this briefly to Paul earlier. There was a conference at Yale at the end of 2013 on non-human personhood, personhood beyond the human, it was called. It was the first time that actually the animal rights people and the android rights people were in the same room together. And these people have different views about things, and rather conflictual views of each other. Because the thing about android rights people that really bothers animal rights people is that there is this presumption and which everybody seems to be willing to take on board as normal, that android rights, when they're given, will be on grounds of autonomy. Right? So the android can decide for itself, the android is self-determining, right? I mean, the reason why I object somewhat to Paul's use of the word consciousness is because I'm not sure consciousness is really that. But what he was discussing, what Paul was discussing, actually captures all that. Right? The ability to make decisions, to bring together things, to set long-term plans, right? To have this kind of thing. And this is going to be grounds on which the rights are given, autonomy. Okay? Otherwise, there's no other kind of basis for rights that's of interest to the android rights people. Because there are a few people out there who get worried about whether the machines can feel pain, but that's not really where the action is on this visit. It's kind of where Paul's at, where Paul doesn't mention pain at all, except when it happens to humans. Right? The machine doesn't feel pain. Right? The machine might register error and say, I got to improve my judgment next time so this joker doesn't get killed. But the point is that the machine doesn't feel pain. Okay, and the people in android rights don't worry about that too much. But of course, in animal rights, people do worry a lot about that. In fact, when one talks about the grounds on which animal rights are given, is normally what, you know, this idea of sentience, right, which is about the feeling of pain, ultimately, right? The bottom line is, if they didn't suffer, we've got to protect them. And that is the spirit in which one goes into the animal rights argument. So the autonomy that the animals end up getting on the back of that is the autonomy from humans. Not the autonomy to live among humans, which is what the android rights people write. Right? The only reason why artificial intelligence is such a threat to humanity is because we're imagining it's going to be with us. Right? It's because we imagine they're going to be living with us. That's why they're a threat to humanity. If we thought we were going to put them in some reservation out there, all those machines in some, you know, theme park for AI, that wouldn't be a problem. But you see, animal rights people actually think that is where animals should go, into sanctuaries, right? Where they can live their own animal-like existence, not threatened by humans, right, in their own natural ecologies. That is the kind of ideal goal of animal rights as a way of protecting them from the harm that can be inflicted by humans. Okay? It's a totally different conception of what the rights are about and what the autonomy entitles you to. So animal autonomy basically entitles animals to live amongst themselves in their own natural environments, end of story. Whereas with the android rights, autonomy entitles them to live with humans, even to the point of perhaps becoming indistinguishable and superior to humans. It's a complete integration strategy, as opposed to a segregation strategy. And this was where you got the really interesting kinds of disagreements going on here with regard to you know, what rights should be valued. Because there are two questions that come from this, right? One question is, could we have a world that respected all at once human rights, animal rights, and android rights, given the way I described animal rights and android? Could you have a world like that? Okay, that would be one question. And the other question I think is kind of interesting from a biomimetic standpoint is what characteristics of the human are being, as it were, abstracted to give us the notion of android rights on the one hand, and to give us the notion of animal rights on the other. Because one of the things that I would submit to you, speaking as someone who does social and political theory and things like this, is if you look at the rhetoric, for example, of animal rights, it is very much the rhetoric that is borrowed from things like multiculturalism, right, the whole business of dispossessed peoples, right, that kind of idea, indigenous populations that have been uprooted, right? Animal rights discourse, as it were, resonates with that kind of conception of the human being. The human beings, are rooted in certain cultures and so forth, and when they're taken away from it and are exploited by it, they can no longer be what they really are. And there is that aspect of humanity that resonates to. But on the other hand, if you look at the android rights people, they're talking about reason and intelligence, and they're talking about all of these self-transcending modes, right? And it's a very much more abstract, universalist kind of notion, okay? And both of these, and these are rhetorics that are very much rooted, in the human rights tradition, actually, in quite different strands of the human rights tradition. One, emphasizing, protecting, endangered peoples, and on the other hand, the idea of empowerment, right, of indefinite empowerment to people, which is also part of the human rights tradition. That is in particular what the android stuff appeals to. So my point in bringing all this up is that, insofar as we talk about wanting to model this on that, and we've now got these kinds of, we have this kind of arrangement where we're sort of recognizing that there's an animal world out there, and there's an android world, and there's a human world, and that somehow these things can, there are, as it were, functionalities that one has that could be transferred to the other. Which ones are we talking about here? And is there some kind of world in which we could all live, coexist? Or will it be a case of one dominating overall, right? Because all of the scares about artificial intelligence, right, does suggest that in some sense the artificial intelligence, because it abstracts away, as it were, the most powerful features of the human condition and amplifies them, will ultimately be the master of everything. That's a narrative that's already in circulation. But is that the case, really? Right? It seems to me that, people in this community might want to kind of think about that a little bit, and also to think a little bit more, explicitly about the relationship with animals. Because I think that relationship is going to get more and more interesting as time goes on, and these kinds of virtual pets, that we've been talking about here, that's just a kind of thin edge of the wedge with regard to sort of blurring the difference between the android and the animal. Okay, so I'll stop here and take some questions. We've got a few minutes. Is that okay?
Yeah, we're fine.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, question for Steve. Please.
So with the virtual pets, you mentioned that people were trying to hack them to keep them alive.
That's right.
I mean, some people just like challenge or like avoiding pain for stuff. So I think what would be interesting is to give them the option to pay to keep their current one alive or get a new one for free.
Well, that's a good point. No, and I think when the thing goes commercial, those kinds of options might get put on the table. I think that's a very good idea, actually.
But remember, this is still kind of in the pilot stage. So in a sense, the reason why I know about this is because I know the designer, and she's telling me kind of what's going on behind the scenes before it comes out. But that's entirely possible, and that would be an interesting kind of experiment with regard to what's really at play here.
Yeah. So Steve, there's another form which you can think about biomimetics, which is not necessarily from a copying perspective, but it's about integrating different sources of constraints, which as an end result gives you something that looks like whatever that phenomenon was.
Yes.
Right? So when I talk about biomimetics, it's more about really modeling that biological system as opposed to copying some feature.
No, I agree. In fact, I think that what you're talking about is actually the better way to go. That was my point about the Socrates thing, right? Because since Socrates was saying, you know, we have to look at the entire human being and what's the function of madness in the entire human being, not just with regard to the pure, you know, the limited functionality of love.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly.
Yeah.
But now, to what extent do you think that then, if you look at the Android case, right? To what extent should the android then have the similar capabilities to distinguish life from death as you would? Does it need a full-fledged metaphysics to deal with us in this autonomous sense or not?
Wow, that's a good question because a lot depends. I mean, there's a sense in which, Emily will may be disappointed, but I actually believe the difference between life and death is getting blurred a bit. Okay? I know you don't believe this, but the gentleman who was standing there was on the money. It seems to me that insofar as resurrection is possible, you see, so in other words, I think at the moment, this seems like a really important question because we imagine death to be irreversible. Okay? But if you imagine that death might not be irreversible, then in some sense you could come back to life. And maybe, you know, if not come back to life in the biological form, but in some digital form. In other words, if there are several options, as it were, beyond the death moment, okay, then it becomes a little bit more complicated. But in a way, I kind of take your point at the level at which you're asking.
But it is a counterfactual, right? Because what you're saying is that the autonomous car, before killing the pedestrian, downloads the mind of the pedestrian and it leaves behind the hard disk with that person on it.
That would be interesting. That would be like a new sense of insurance policy.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
I think it would solve a lot of our problems.
Thanks. That was brilliant. I so much enjoyed that. I wondered about the quick comment and a question about the life and death thing. I think it's really interesting that you're drawing death as a moment or pinpointing death as a moment. I think a lot of sociologists would talk about death as a process.
Yeah, whatever.
The question then is, you said something about we need to exploit animals for the best that they can do rather than reinventing the wheel, you know, through silicon and that. And I've never thought about that before. And I'm quite obsessed with rabbits, for instance, because I think rabbits are just, you know, they do everything. They're performative, you can eat them, they're pets. You know. But taking you seriously on that topic, what would you see? How would you put that forward then? How could we exploit animals in the best function?
Well, see, first of all,
right? Let's just take that. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. First of all, I think, to be honest with you, I think this is exactly how B.S. Skinner thought about animals. That's what I thought it meant. And if you know about his career, he went through lots of different animals to do the trying to figure out what's the right environment in which what they do turns out. I know he has a bad reputation. I understand.
Seriously.
I know he does, but I do think that's because see, look, the point about operant conditioning is you start with the assumption that the animal is actually doing something good, right? So you start with a very positive disposition toward the animal, actually, right? That what, you know, what the animal spontaneously does, without you doing much to it, is good. And then the question becomes, what's the environment in which the results of that can actually give us the most benefit? And so then the whole point is about designing the environment. It's not about re-engineering the animal.
No, that's right. No, I'm taking
you. Okay, okay.
Why bother reinventing the wheel and giving these planes these new automated systems when the pigeons would have just done the job anyway? Where else do you see that kind of like, how else can we exploit them? What other animal might we therefore use instead of an android or a robot or a computer system or something like that? That's
I actually think, I can't give you just rattle a lot of examples, but I would say one of the places to look would be, I think actually some of the environmental stuff actually that wishes us to kind of downsize from our technological commitments. And I think actually it's a bit in tune with that. Maybe not for particularly scientific reasons, right? Maybe more for a kind of aesthetic reason or whatever with regard to nature and so forth. But they may be onto something with regard to energy efficiency, you see? And I think the question is to sort of explore this systematically, which is, I think, the issue, right? Explore it systematically.
No, but isn't there a hidden assumption in this debate which is problematic? Because the animals we're talking about, the European rabbit, we've been breeding those animals for millennia to perform certain functions for us.
Yes.
So this idea of pure identity,
no, you're right.
Right? That is not affected by our functional wishes is not
good. Yes, and this is an argument against animal rights. It seems to me this is an argument against the animal rights movement, what you just said.
Sure, but it also questions a bit the subject of your question, because maybe you can also say, well, we with biological methods we push these animals as far as we can. But right now, for a guided missile, these pigeons are just not good enough.
But we don't actually know that, okay? I mean, I think one of the...
But there's the history. I studied this bit of Skinner's history,
sure.
And already during the Second World War, they gave up because the pigeons were just not good enough. It was inefficient.
No, I think, the way I read the history is I actually think that there was a kind of substrate of bias going on. In other words, the very idea that pigeons could be guiding missiles to win wars in the United States is just a balmy idea, right? I think it was a kind of prejudice that such lowly creatures could have such great impact, that rather what you need is high tech.
But still, in a way, pigeons require maintenance and all these.
Sure, no.
But
that is a real problem.
Once, and that's it. Yeah. In terms of monetary efficiency, it's much more efficient to make it in silico rather than.
It depends what you think the value of pigeons, and this is where the experiment
is. Pigeons, the value of maintaining the pigeon.
I know, you can replace the pigeons, like, this is the point, right? There's a sense in which this is where Skinner doesn't look so good, right? I mean, if you look at the kinds of creatures, you know, he was into grass pigeons, right? I mean, they were breeding, right? You know, not only customized, but en masse, right? Because you're easily replaceable. So you maintain them for a while, but once they start to get problematic, boom, they're gone. The next one comes in.
Then look at, as a counterexample, at these mind-detecting dolphins that are still being used.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there we have sophisticated animals that are expensive to maintain for sure. But we cannot really replace them so easily with our technology.
Right.
Are they falling now in a separate category or not?
No, I think this would be a great example for the kind of thing I'm talking about, actually.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I think the issue is how generalizable this kind of thing is, right? I mean, I think there's an open question there. I don't want to make the claim that every animal has some function that we have yet to figure out, and once we do, we can dispense with all our technology. I'm not saying that. There might be some theological attractiveness to that, I suppose, from a biblical standpoint. But the thing is that I'm not claiming that. But I do think that we shouldn't just assume that everything has to go from carbon to silicon.
Yeah. Other questions?
This is a crack argument. I'm not sure I quite get where Socrates sees the benefit. So he's saying that there's something about the holistic person that's more than the sum of the parts?
Yeah.
So how
does that get? No, but the point is that the kinds of things that we would consider dysfunctional, right, about love, let's say, if we just focus on the love relationship, and we're talking about something that seems dysfunctional about, namely that it seems to be created by all this madness, that ends up potentially having destructive consequences. It only seems so bad because we're operating on the assumption that the madness, as it were, only attaches to the love rather than to the entire personality. And in the entire personality, there are other things that the person does where that madness might actually be a benefit. And in fact, Socrates thinks that madness is actually part of the way he gets to know God. Okay, that's Socrates' view. So in other words, while the madness may in fact be bad in the limited context of the love relationship, it is not bad if you actually take everything that the person is trying to do to be a person, which involves also trying to know God. That's his argument. Right? So things look bad in a relatively limited context, We have to then see what other function it might serve outside of the context you're looking at.
But from my point of view, watching a lover, then I don't want a mad lover. I want a lover.
Yeah, I know you want the lover act. I know. It's the thing. Half ears, right? I
mean, it's all about that. Quick and clean.
No.
You think like Tony's dating profile? Don't you?
No. It actually raises an interesting question because, in terms of the need to have a unified, integrated self, which you presuppose, and I presuppose, but maybe Tony doesn't presuppose, right? Because if all you are is a collection of apps, right, and yourself is just a platform where all those apps sit, right, then in a sense you just deal with each app individually, right? And that is a kind of conception of a self, right? It's a kind of very postmodern, perhaps, conception of the self, right? But that is a different kind of view, and that view is on the table, and actually for transhumanists, right? You know, if you think about transhumanism, where they're very keen on extending particular dimensions indefinitely without thinking about the interaction effects they have on each other, right? So I want to be the smartest, I want to be the strongest, I want to be this, without thinking about interaction effects, it's basically a self consisting of apps. Right? So that is another picture.
Well, pair bonding has a common mechanism that's based on vasopressin and oxytocin in rodents and humans.
Yeah.
So when you take this kind of, poetic love thing out of it, it's just a fundamental mechanism. And many of us in biomimetics are interested in the underlying mechanisms.
Sure.
And modeling the mechanisms. So the Lord Byron part, kind of is...
I just say, the clean version.
Yeah.
I understand. No, I'm not saying that people aren't trying to do this. No. The sophists do have their day.
But the other thing, a hidden issue in your proposal is that, well, we can also look at how we can functionally use biological systems like animals.
Yes.
But on what moral grounds are you allowed to do that if it leads to their destruction?
Yeah.
I don't think you can answer
that. No. That's the real open question. That's why I think that the animal issue is going to be a bigger and bigger issue as time goes on, right? Because, if we go down this route, as it were, exploiting the animal strategically, we run up against the animal rights thing, but in a sense, you already have the beginning of the counter-argument, because you say, look, we've been exploiting these things for centuries already. There's no such thing as a pure animal, right? These animals, for the most part, are already part of us. And in that respect, we have a kind of custodial responsibility for their welfare, because they can no longer go back to some quote natural state. No, I think that's the basis of the answer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. All right, so Steve, thank you very much.